Turns out some laws don't apply to the president after all. Conflict of interest is where we start today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 15th of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Sometime in the mid-afternoon of January 20th next, President Donald Trump is going to drive down Pennsylvania Avenue from his inauguration to the White House. Almost exactly a mile into that trip, he will pass on his left-hand side the new Trump International Hotel in what used to be the old post office building, which the Trump Organization operates under a lease with the federal government, the government of which Mr. Trump will by that time be the president. The president-elect has said he's going to leave the day-to-day management of the Trump Organization to three of his children, children who are now officially members of his transition team, meaning they will be involved in political decisions that could impact said family business. The company does say it is going to comply, quote, with all applicable rules and regulations, but potential conflict of interest here are not hard to see. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, the solutions are far from simple.
Here are just a few examples of how sticky things can get when a billionaire businessman trades the corner office for the oval one. Presidents oversee the National Labor Relations Board. Just days before the election, the NLRB ruled that a Trump hotel in Las Vegas broke federal law in its treatment of workers. Trump will also appoint the head of the IRS, which he says is currently auditing his taxes.
This is unprecedented. We've never had a president go from the private sector into the government with vast business holdings.
Kenneth Gross heads the political law practice at Skadden Arps. He says those holdings include more than 500 companies. Trump's predecessors have traditionally tried to avoid conflicts by creating blind trusts. Gross says turning the business over to one's children isn't the same.
When it comes to the children's success, they're coextensive with his own personal self-interest, so it doesn't really take care of the conflict problem.
Richard Painter was the chief ethics lawyer in the George W. Bush White House from 2005 to 2007. He says Congress could pass legislation to try to minimize conflicts in cases involving Trump businesses.
It will be very important to make sure that those matters are handled by career civil servants in those agencies and not by political appointees.
But Painter says that doesn't address potential conflicts in policymaking, like regulating the banks that finance Trump's real estate empire. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
As if the press didn't have enough problems after the recent election, there is also the issue of fake news to deal with now. Both Google and Facebook, upon which literally billions of people rely to get their news, have been used by bogus news sites this election cycle. This week, the two companies said they're going to do something about that. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, let's get the basics first, I guess. What are Google and Facebook doing to combat, take your pick, all this fake news online?
Well, what they're doing in a nutshell is they're trying to choke off the money. Google updated or said it is working on a policy change that will prevent its AdSense software, so its ad selling software, from being used on websites that propagate false information. Facebook issued an update and said that it was already implied that its rules prevented websites that propagate fake news from using its ad selling network, but it wanted to clarify that fact.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but didn't Mark Zuckerberg, the guy who, owns Facebook, just say like two, 3 days ago he thought it was crazy that fake news had any influence and nothing to see here, move along?
He did. He did say almost exactly that, yes. And then on the other hand, thought maybe it's a good idea to just clarify our policies so that people aren't making money off of fake news, which we know, at least according to one investigation by BuzzFeed, that some people were, that teenagers in Macedonia were making up to $5,000 by injecting fake stories.
Say that again. Teenagers in Macedonia.
It's like amazing the world we live in right now, isn't it? Teenagers in Macedonia running a viral fake news scheme and making a pretty decent chunk of change. So they're trying to stop that. And that seems reasonable as a way to say, look, we will choke off the funding, but we don't want to get into an argument about whether we did or did not tip the election.
Back me out here for a minute and talk to me about it's a much bigger question. This idea of Facebook as a media company or Facebook, no, we're just a platform. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Google's in the same boat, and we have not faced a conversation like this before in American media. And so I'm willing to cut a medium amount of slack to these executives as they try to figure out how to balance the fact that their mission, ultimately, when they started, neither of them, neither Google nor Facebook, got into this business to be publishers and to be news sources, but they are, and they do have to figure out. And I think it is a pragmatic start to say, if we can remove a financial incentive, we'll start there, and then we'll see what happens, because it gets really, you know, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, totally. Do you roll Twitter in there, by the way, you know, the platform with which the president-elect of the United States had so much success?
You know, I think that you have to at some point, except that it's smaller.
Huh.
And that is the only thing that has kept Twitter out of this conversation so far, is that it's smaller and the reach is not as profound. I mean, Facebook has, what, more than triple, maybe quadruple the number of users, and interferes more. The thing that keeps Twitter out, too, is that, look, Facebook gets in there. Facebook censors your feed. It rearranges your algorithm. It says that some stories shouldn't be published. So they are in a trickier position, I think, even than Twitter, which its hands-off approach has been problematic, but at least it's hands-off.
Yeah. Real quick, is this going to fix anything, or is this just the end of the beginning of this conversation?
It's a start. A financial disincentive is a start. However, you open up this Pandora's box. If they have the technology to figure out that the sites are fake and keep the ads off them, why can't they keep the stories off their platforms?
Right. Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Wall Street today was up, but let's not get carried away. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Donald Trump took 63% of the vote in Alabama last Tuesday, the biggest margin of victory in a presidential race there in almost a half a century. We asked Gigi Duban to find out what was on voters' minds.
Mark Pearson is one of 1.3 million people in Alabama who voted for Donald Trump. He's worked two jobs for the last 22 years. He commutes more than 60 miles a day from Blount County, north of Birmingham.
I am a firefighter full-time, and I work at a body shop part-time.
Between the two jobs, he puts in 70 to 75 hours a week. His wife currently doesn't work, and as with the family he grew up in, he says she shouldn't have to. I caught up with him at the body shop. Pearson says he got into auto body work when he was in high school, and he wanted to paint his own car. He got a job at a shop.
I realized, listening to the older guys when I was back getting into it, they kept saying, boy, you need to get out of this business. You need to get out of this business. It's going nowhere.
He didn't get out of the business, but he did take his firefighter test, a job that today gives him and his wife health benefits. At 51, these two jobs wear on him.
I can't work like I was 30. I can't work like a 24-year-old. I'm getting older. I feel it every morning when I get out of bed. Those knees, you feel those knees every time you get up out of the recliner. You go, ugh, and you used to not do that.
He says he's at the age when he and his wife will need to go to the doctor more. He needs health insurance. Premiums have been rising. He pays $400 a month for he and his wife.
You know, the last, I don't know how many years, this just keeps going up and up and up and up. And it, again, it's not changing unless we get people in there who say we've got to make a difference for everybody else.
Trump, Pearson says, is the person to lead that charge. Pearson doesn't want Trump to repeal the Affordable Care Act, just to tweak it so that health care is more affordable for younger people who don't visit the doctor very often, and for small businesses, like the body shop where he works. As it stands, health care is so expensive that employers either have to keep a stable of part-timers without benefits or pass those high costs on to employees.
They can't afford to pay the employees a little bit more because margins are just cut so tight. That I think he could, he's probably got some ideas on how to do that because he's done it for years. He's built an empire, which is, it's no small task.
Jill Leith owns Faith Consignments in Alabaster, Alabama, a city about 30 miles south of Birmingham.
Faith Consignment can help you.
Leith's shop is on a busy strip with plenty of pawn shops, check cashing places, and mobile home sales lots. She voted for Trump because she believes he'll make the economy stronger.
I have noticed within the last 4 years that sales have been down a lot, and I just feel like people are scared to spend money.
She says people are spending more on things like healthcare, so they're shopping less.
Everything is all just bunching up on everybody, even me.
4 years ago, she had 5 employees. Today, she has 1. Her mother, whom she hired part-time so that she'd have an income.
Just with the economy and the slowing down of business, I have not been able to afford to keep certain employees on.
And if Trump fulfills his promise to help small businesses and stabilize the economy, she says, it'll be more money in everyone's pocket. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Warren Buffett watches airlines real close, and for years he has said they were a lousy investment. Until all of a sudden, they're not. Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, disclosed big new holdings in 4 major airlines this week, American, Delta, United, and Southwest for good measure. Which means exactly what for you and me, the flying public? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
This really was a turn for Buffett, who famously referred to airlines as the worst sort of business back in the 1980s. But today's airline market is different. After consolidation, there are basically 3 major U.S. airlines, American, Delta, and United. Richard Gritta teaches finance and transportation at the University of Portland.
Fact is, the probabilities of failure have gone way, way down from the days when, you know, airline bankruptcy was not only not uncommon, but frequent.
Carola Scannone says those airlines had gotten too big and needed to scale back. She's a professor of finance at the University of Virginia.
So they have all really, I think, benefited through bankruptcy.
She says the consumer is the one who will pay for the airline's added efficiency.
You will have to make a lot more connections. And the other thing is you're going to pay more.
Long gone are the days when you could score cheap flights just because you were traveling off-season. Jim Corridor is an airline equity analyst at CFR Research.
What's happening now in the marketplace is if there's a sustained soft patch, airlines are taking capacity out. They're cutting flights, they're selling planes or parking them. So over time, that's going to lead to higher fares for consumers.
But Michael Boyd says we're looking at it all wrong. He's an aviation industry consultant.
This is a commodity, and depending what the price is, the demand will go up or down. There isn't a business in the world that wants to produce too much product just to lower its costs and make less money.
And that's certainly not the kind of business Warren Buffett has made billions investing in. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you're paying your debt back to society. So then they're going to charge you an additional per night stay as if there were some options.
Paying for your crime twice. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials was up 54 points today, 0.3%, a record 18,923 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 57 points, about 1.1%, 5275. The S&P 500 up 0.7%, 16 points, 2180. Banks retreated a bit after days of gains. J.P. Morgan Chase off 0.1%. Wells Fargo dropped 0.1%. After Warren Buffett's big bet on the airlines that Euler was telling you about, that sector took off. American Airlines rose 0.3%. United up 5% today. Commerce Department said total retail sales rose in October from a month earlier. That's good news early for retailers, but Home Depot closed down 2.5%. Walmart, though, up 0.1%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Chinese President Xi Jinping and the president-elect of these United States, Donald J. Trump, had a chat Sunday night. All the appropriate things were said by both sides after the call, but as is so often the case in Sino-American relations, there are layers upon layers of the relationship between the world's two biggest economies to peel back. James Fallows does that in the cover story in the new issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called China's Great Leap Backward. Jim, it's really good to talk to you again.
Kai, nice to talk to you.
We should say at the outset of this conversation that this piece in The Atlantic was written before the election, obviously, yeah?
It was. We had to come out with an issue that would come out after the election we thought would cover concerns of whoever was the next president. But frankly, I was not expecting, like most people, I wasn't expecting that these would be prescriptions for a Trump administration.
Exactly. So let us back up for a second and reestablish your bona fides, which we have done on this program before. You have spent a good part of the past decade plus either living in China or working there frequently. You have virtually constant contact with people there in the economic and social and political spheres. And you say in this piece that things have changed.
Starting about a year ago, I went through my friends who had been on the China beat for a long time, Americans, Europeans, Asians, Chinese, saying, does something seem different out of China now because of the emerging shape of the Xi Jinping regime? And increasingly, their arguments were that something was different from the China we'd known from back in the Nixon, Kissinger, Chairman Mao era of the 1970s. So that's what I was trying to say. If China was really changing, both internally and externally, did it dictate some different frame of reference from the United States and whoever was its next president?
Refresh us that frame then, if you would, because for 45 years, the American and really the Chinese approach has been, listen, we've got some differences, but we got to work through this together.
Yes. The breakthrough that Richard Nixon and Chairman Mao established, and that I would argue every American president from Richard Nixon through, crucially, Barack Obama maintained, was the idea, number one, that it was better for both countries if they could work as difficult partners rather than being enemies or adversaries. Number two, that it was better for the United States, and this was an important point, if China grew and prospered rather than if it stagnated, because whatever problems a prospering China created for the world, a stagnating, fractious, falling apart China would create worse problems. And number three, there would still be disagreements, but over time, the American assumption was those disagreements would become more manageable. Not that China would become democratic, but it would become sort of more internationalized and part of the world sphere.
And that frame is basically because, especially now in this era of globalization that has accelerated the past number of years, we are in essence one entity, right? I mean, we've got separate spheres of influence and all that, to quote a phrase, but economically and politically and in some ways culturally, we are one grouping.
Yes. And the differences between China and the United States, we could spend the next 10 hours talking about. But, you know, number one, in economic integration, it's almost impossible to find any company in America, in the United States, large or small, that doesn't have an important relationship with China. It could be its supply chain. It could be its markets. It could be the way that non-commercial enterprises like universities are increasingly reliant on Chinese students as part of their population base, their student base, but also part of their international role in the world. The same thing is true in a different way in China, where its connection with the world economy through the United States has been a very important part of its rise out of poverty over the last 40 years or so. And in surprisingly broad realms of international cooperation, the United States and China have done things together that make a big difference. Certainly the most important is climate issues, where if the United States and China, the two major emitters in the world, don't solve this problem together, there is no hope for anybody.
Okay, so let me then read you back to yourself, and we will say once again that this was written before the election, but you said no sane American leader would choose confrontation with China. The next president has no rational choice but to keep trying to make the best of this relationship. And here we have a man who will take over on January 20th, who is going to tear up the TPP, who is skeptical of climate change, and who has campaigned literally on the idea that China is doing its best to hurt us.
I think this will be example number one or, you know, number 10,000 of what we learn or what we can expect from a Donald Trump presidency related to the way candidate Donald Trump campaigned, because the things that Donald Trump said during the campaign were inflammatory and often grossly misinformed. For example, one of his standard lines in his campaign speeches was that China was artificially holding down the value of its currency. I mean, certainly China manages its currency, but recently has been holding it up, you know, the opposite of what Trump has said. So we will now see, based on the phone call that Xi Jinping and Donald Trump have apparently had, what the path forward is.
I'll preface this last question by saying that you were a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter in the Carter White House, and you end this piece with what in normal circumstances would be a speech, a foreign policy speech that a new president might give as he lays out his vision for the world. And you say in your version of the speech to end this article, so China, here we are. We can do it one of two ways. We can do this relationship the easy way, or we can do it the hard way. We hope to be easy and have cooperation, but we're ready for the hard way. What does that look like?
The hard way, if we assume anything like a normal policy-making universe on the U.S. side with its allies is saying that for 40 years we have assumed that everybody is better off if China continues to prosper. But if there are signs that that assumption is flawed, we need to prepare for ways to make China's development in ways that are harmful to the world less attractive for China. That is changing the reality in which they operate, whether it's alliance, military alliances in that part of the world, whether it's denying them privileges they would like, as opposed to the sort of outright bluster and lecturing that has never for anybody paid off with China. The question for all of us now is whether that kind of subtle backstage reshaping of realities is even a possibility for the new American regime.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, has been for many years. His most recent piece is called China's Great Leap Backward. Jim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
We did some stories a couple of years ago about the juvenile justice system and how parents often have to pay if their kids are incarcerated. In some California counties, it can cost parents as much as $30 a day for room and board, more if there are ankle monitors or probation officers involved. Parents pay for all of that. From Youth Radio, Miles Bass has this update to our series. It was called Double Charged.
Back in 2014, when I met Zoe Matthews, she was in a tough position. Her son had died, but she was still paying bills for the time he spent in juvenile hall. It was more than $7,000.
It's a constant reminder that, no, he's not here anymore.
Matthew's son was locked up for 208 days at a cost of almost $30 per day.
By being incarcerated, you're paying your debt back to society. So then they're going to charge you an additional per night stay as if there were some options. The bills are additional stress to already a very painful situation that I will be dealing with for the rest of my life.
It almost felt like you were at the checkout line at Target or something, and you were just getting this receipt for how much money you owed.
That's lawyer Kate Weisberg talking about how the juvenile system used to work in Alameda County. Teens and their families ended up with piles of bills they didn't expect. Since the majority of her clients are low income, the impact was huge. After Youth Radio covered the issue for Marketplace, the East Bay Community Law Center, where Weisberg works, partnered with Berkeley's Law School. They did some digging into the fees.
To see how much was being collected, how much was being ordered for young people and their families to pay, and where did that money go?
The county was paying staff to administer and collect these fees, but the actual revenue was tiny because the families who were being charged often couldn't afford to pay. So Weisberg and her collaborators took their findings to county supervisors like Richard Valle. He says the board was surprised when they saw the breakdown and heard about families having to choose between paying groceries and paying county bills.
There were substantial amounts of damage being done to families because of those fees. And the impact to our general fund, which is well over $2.5 billion per year, was minimal.
So the county voted unanimously to stop charging fees and forgive all past debt. Now other California counties are dropping fees too. But it's hard to say how many states will follow suit. Valle says a lot of places still charge fees for their bottom lines.
For a lot of governments across the country, there aren't too many mechanisms or opportunities to make revenue or create revenue for infrastructure. So this was a bona fide method that people felt had some merit.
People assume that charging young people money will make them more accountable. It will somehow help them and it will help public safety.
That's Jessica Fireman. She's with the Juvenile Law Center based in Philadelphia. Her organization surveyed 41 states about fees for juveniles and researched their impact.
What was really interesting about the criminology research is that it showed the opposite. It showed that young people who had fees imposed and fines imposed, and especially large ones, were more likely to offend again after their time was done in the juvenile justice system.
In other words, the effects of the fees ran counter to the mission of the juvenile justice system, which is all about rehabilitation. That's why some California legislators are looking at getting rid of juvenile court fees statewide. For now, all 50 states still impose some kind of fine or fee on juveniles. In Oakland, I'm Miles Best for Marketplace.
Miles' story was produced for us by Youth Radio, a follow-up to their series, Double Charged.
final note on the way out today, Gallup has some new numbers out about Americans' confidence in their economy. Overall, the polling people say we've moved from slightly negative about the economy in tracking polls taken the first week of November, that is, before the election, to slightly positive since. You break it down by party, though, and that's where the insight is. Before the election, 61% of Dems were positive, 49% after. The GOP is the keeper here. Before the election, just 16% of Republicans thought the economy was getting better. Afterward, 49%. All right, we got a boogie. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. There's a new episode of our podcast, Politics Inside Out, dropping this afternoon. Me and Andrea Seabrook on the economics of American politics on Trump Plus 7. Check it out. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.